Welcome to Voice Rising with Kara Johnstad. Enjoy weekly conversations with leading luminaries, pioneering visionaries, singers, poets, musicians, and sound healers as we explore the profound role our voice plays on the path to self-realization and global enlightenment. The internationally acclaimed singer, composer, author, healer, recording artist, voice expert, creator of Voice Your Essence, and founder of the School of Voice, Kara Johnstad uses her extraordinary spiritual gifts to empower others. Everything in this world vibrates. Everything has a frequency. A pioneer in the field of voice work and transformational songwriting, her breakthrough methods are helping thousands of people worldwide fine-tune their body-mind-spirit system and unlock the energetic frequencies of limitless creativity, health, and abundance. Share your voice, ask your questions, join in the conversation. Receive life-changing, positive transformation and rise together to create a sound world. And here's your host, Kara Johnstad.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Voice Rising. I have in studio with me today the modern-day feminist activist April Young Bennett, author of Ask a Suffragist book series, host of the Religious Feminism podcast, and a seasoned and articulate voice for women's equality. So welcome, April. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Nice. So, April, you are dedicated to the realization of compassionate communication in all realms of human life. And I would love to start this interview in a very easy place. I'd love to know, where were you as a young girl as far as voice is concerned? Were you able to express your ideas and your imagination freely? Or did you have the feeling that you were held back in some way of doing that?
I'm one of those fortunate people who came from a pretty happy childhood. And So I was very comfortable expressing my voice. However, I would say that as a child and as a young person, I was a feminist on weekdays, but not on Sundays. On Sundays was the one time of the week where I would turn my feminism off and just kind of go along with the patriarchy, because that's how I was trained. I was trained to just go out there and take on the world every day except for Sunday. Sundays are different. Church is different.
Right. So do you remember a memory from that childhood that defined you and spurred you on to be the voice for so many women today?
Yes. In my church, I'm a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that we're often referred to as Mormons. And in our faith, when children turn 12 years old, almost every male child universally is ordained to the priesthood. And so they become what is called a priesthood holder, and they have special duties. One of the most important is that they pass the sacrament, our communion, to the other congregants on Sundays. And girls are not allowed to do this, only boys. And when I was 12, I was in my Sunday school class. I had the worst, rowdiest, horrible boys in my Sunday school class. They were just terrible. They would throw spit wads. They would knock over chairs so that people would trip. They would copycat teachers and the female students. They were just bullies. They were terrible. And I remember thinking to myself, why on earth would God choose these bullies to hold his priesthood and represent his gospel, and not any of the students in the class who were capable of reverence, all the girls?
And so after that defining moment of being 12 and seeing so many boys be able to step up into a different leadership role, it slumbered probably inside of you, but you started to become a little bit more active for your voice as a teenager and then into womanhood.
Right. I started to notice other things and sort of to test my boundaries of expressing my concerns and my opinions about this inequality. But it wasn't until years later, I think, when I finally reached the point where I felt strong enough to go out there and express my voice in the form of activism. Not until I was married with children.
Right. So since the Women's March in Washington and the big Me Too movement and the intersecting movements such as Black Lives Matter, the feminist movement has mobilized and expanded to engage everyday people. It's been a very, very big, you know, I'm very grateful for this, that the movement is strong. And a new diverse generation of feminists is raising questions about how can we use our voice to affect change. And what are your suggestions? How can we make our voices heard?
I think we need to, we can follow some of the things that our suffragist foremothers did. Mm-hmm. They went through so many barriers. At their time, it was considered improper for a woman to speak out to any audience that contained men. It was thought that it was great for men to come out and raise their voices to whoever they pleased, to everyone. But women should only talk to other women. They shouldn't keep speak out in front of men, and the men shouldn't be required to listen to women. And so their voices weren't always welcome. And one thing that they did is they showed up at places where they weren't welcome, places mm-hmm. where men had specifically told them, this meeting is for men, don't come. Mm-hmm. And they mm-hmm. showed up anyway. And they just required people to hear them and see them and know that they were there. I've had similar experiences in my modern activism. There was a time when I was one of the leaders of a group called Ordained Women, and mm-hmm. a group of 500 women of our faith marched to a male-only meeting held by our church. And we requested entrance one at a time. We lined up at the doors of the building, and each of us approached the door and asked the usher if we could come in. And each person, one at a time, 500 people, this took a while, was refused. One thing they did say they were willing to do is they said, here's what we'll do. As a compromise, we'll broadcast what's going on in the meeting over the internet, and you can listen outside. So you can't participate, but you can listen. And this reminded me of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott. They mm-hmm. tried to attend the World Anti-Slavery Society Convention in London in 1840, and they were told, women are not invited to this meeting, don't come, but they showed up anyway. And when they got there, they were barred at the door. They said, women can't come in here, but here's what we'll do. We'll let you listen to the meeting from the balcony behind a curtain, so nobody can mm-hmm. see or hear you, but you can hear us. And I realized we're doing the exact same thing in my modern community. And so there's many things we can learn from them about just arriving at places where you may not be wanted. And even if they don't let you speak, they see you there and they see you protesting this exclusion.
It is fascinating always for me, also as a very strong voice and a feminist, to remember that all of the men that are denying you entrance to these meetings have mothers. I mean, they're all coming from women, right? They were all brought to this world by women, and yet the women are not included. It always boggles my mind. In your new book, which is, congratulations, I believe it was just published officially yesterday or the day before,
yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
Brand new.
Yeah, brand new, entitled Ask a Suffragist, Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminists. You channel the wisdom in this book of the first generation of American feminists as advisors to help us find those solutions that are relevant to our modern world. And I'm curious, as a voice coach, about the lineage, voice as a lineage. It fascinates me that a voice can be carried from generation to generation, and it's how we evolve. Are we standing on the shoulders of our elders? Is it their voices that are guiding us all the time when we also go and knock on those doors, like you did with your ordained ministers?
Yes, in many ways we are benefiting from what they did, even if we don't know what they did. Mm-hmm. Because those opportunities that we have, those traditions of demonstrating and speaking out and being activists, we learned those from generation to generation from the people who came before us. And a lot of times I think we think because now it's so different, we have the internet, we have radio and TV, it's easier to communicate now than it was back then, that everything has changed. But really, a lot of the things that we do when we're trying to raise our voices have not changed. Mm-hmm. We still need to find allies. We still need to persuade people who fervently disagree with us to understand our point of view. And we still need to work with people that maybe share some common goals with us, but in other ways are very different from us. And so many of the same challenges that people addressed who came before us still apply today.
Right. I'm sure it involves not only raising our voices, but also a lot of deep listening and work in civil communication and conversations. I can imagine it must be very, a delicate balance to work together and find solutions with an audience that is not of the same opinion. It takes a lot of training, right? Yeah.
Yeah. If you're just raising your voice, but you're not listening, you're probably just making noise.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's true. Now, I was going to say, so on this day, which is, I believe it's 100 years ago, June 4th, your book was just released, 1919, the United States Congress passed the 19th, it's interesting, 1919, passed the 19th Amendment, guaranteeing the first wave of American women the right to vote, right? And yet I was also researching, because I hadn't really realized that many people, although it was passed, this amendment, they still could not vote in certain states or because of certain things such as being Native American or in certain southern states being Black. If that's correct, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I was wondering if, in honor of those giants whose shoulders we stand upon, we deepen our conversation of the female movers and shakers, right? How can we celebrate that day? I think a lot of people are not even aware how precious our vote is in our political arena.
It is precious, and I don't think that we fully defended it yet. It's something that we have to always revisit, mm-hmm. because there are always people trying to pass laws to prevent people that they think won't vote for them from voting. And mm-hmm. so we do see lots of voting repression laws that still happen today. And so the suffrage movement isn't over. And I like how you talk about how it didn't really get finished at the time of the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Neither did it begin there. Really, that's sort of a marker that we look to when we're thinking about women's suffrage. But mm-hmm. really, there was a much longer timeline than that. The first women in the United States who were granted the right to vote lived in the Western territories in Wyoming and Utah and Idaho. And they won the right to vote 50 years before the 19th Amendment. Mm-hmm. Women in these Western territories had won that right. And I think part of the reason is because they weren't quite as steeped in tradition as their Eastern neighbors. They were out in the West, they were forming new communities, and people were a little more open to new ideas. But they were working for it. They were working hard. And a lot of those women in the East who didn't win the right to vote during their lifetime were working for the benefit of these Western women who won that right in the Western United States. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said, after the 19th Amendment was passed, in theory, that gave women the right to vote. But there were many women who didn't actually get to exercise that right. Mm-hmm. At that time, indigenous people of the United States were not considered United States citizens. They were only considered citizens of their individual tribes. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until after a few years later, after an Indian Citizenship Act was passed, that those indigenous women, some of them, had the opportunity to vote. But there were still very many racist laws preventing them from doing so. And the same was true for Black women in the South. There were many laws that were designed to prevent women from voting, women and men, but it's particularly women and men of color. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these laws weren't specifically about, they didn't say the word race, but they were exercised in a way that made it possible for the white people who held most of the positions of authority to block people of color from voting. They were things like they had taxes so they could prevent poor people from voting. And most people of color did not have the incomes that white people did. Mm-hmm. Or they would have literacy tests. And even if these people of color were literate, when they arrived at the polls, they would give a very difficult test to a person of color and a very easy test or skip the test for a white person.
Right.
And it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that a lot of these things were remedied. And like I said, even since then, since we've had that Voting Rights Act, there are still very many things that keep on cropping up where people are trying to block certain demographics of people from voting through laws.
Yeah, and I was researching more, I guess, on this when I was preparing the interview for today. And I was amazed. I'm in Berlin in the moment, but in Switzerland, 1971 was the year that women were able to vote in national elections, 1971. I mean, that just
yikes.
Very much surprised me, right? In Germany, it was one of the first countries in Europe where women were able to vote. But in Switzerland, 1971, they were able to vote before that in their communal elections, but not in the national elections. And I think, you know, I really think that your book is very important because it is... showing us also how long this has been going on, the suppression, actually, of women's voices. We are 50% of the population, and we have many things to contribute to our world and the society. And it's really great to see a book not only addressing what we can do now, but also honoring the voices of the past that have paved the way for us to be where we are now, right? So
great.
We're going to take a little break, April, and we're going to be back in 1 or 2 minutes with the next part of this interview.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Connect at omtimes.com. Om Times, creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Conflict comes in many forms and often triggers a fight or flight response. Some of us gravitate toward conflict, while many will stop at little to nothing to avoid it. Unfortunately, what we resist will persist, which often forces us to face our fear and deal with it head on. Join me during my show, Conflict Rising, as I discuss the important role of conflict with leaders who have moved through it successfully. Tune in Thursdays at 3 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Remember, it's always darkest before the dawn.
With happy clients all over the world, Kara Johnstad knows that your voice is the missing link to more authenticity, abundance, creativity, and health. An internationally acclaimed voice expert, Kara's breakthrough methods have helped thousands of people successfully heal their voice wounds and extinguish the story of self-doubt and shyness forever. Join in group trainings, attend online sessions, schedule one-on-one time, and invite Kara to work with your organization and community. Get started today. Go to www.karajohnstad.com. and receive a special guided meditation designed to fine-tune your inner voice and welcome you on the voice journey.
Why was the basketball court all wet?
Because the players kept dribbling on it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
What did the buffalo say when he dropped his son off for school?
Bye, son.
So take a moment to make your kid laugh, because dad jokes rule. Make your kid laugh today. Go to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
We are back in studio, and with me today is a modern-day feminist activist, April Young Bennett, author, speaker, and a seasoned and articulate voice for women's equality. And we were talking about April's newest book. And I would love to simply ask you a very daring question, April. With women making up half of our population, we are a very strong force in the world. Why do you think that women's voices have been silenced and continue to be silenced?
One of the reasons, I think, is because this is something that Antoinette Brown talked about. She was the first Protestant woman ordained to the ministry, and it took a lot of work to get there, and she had a lot of opposition. And one of the things she said is that she thinks there was so much opposition because the male clergymen had so much power that they were afraid to share it, afraid to give it up, that it just meant too much for them to be in charge. And this was an unknown entity. What would women do if they were jumping in there and sharing that voice? And they were afraid of losing something. And today, both men and women are often afraid of losing something with change. And when we talk about patriarchy, within the feminist movement, we talk about patriarchy a lot. Sometimes people think in their heads, oh, you mean men. But it's not just men. Patriarchy is a system that men and women participate in, and many women benefit from patriarchy. They hold certain positions because maybe they're the wife of somebody who's a powerful man, or maybe because they support powerful men in their workplace, they receive certain privileges there. And so a lot of people are afraid that they might have to give up some of the privileges they enjoy now if they let change happen.
Powerful thought, how we both participate in both sides of it, right? I think it's a powerful thought. In researching this book, you were able to hear more clearly the voices of the first wave of American suffragists by studying their writings. I found it very interesting that you actually found some of their diaries and journals. Was it difficult to find? I can imagine it must have been very difficult to find their personal writings to really, discover what they were like, what their lifestyle was like, what they were doing.
I would say yes and no. It's easier than ever to do research because so many libraries are putting their archives online. Mm-hmm. And so you can dig up things in ways you couldn't before. However, it takes a while. It's not like they're, when you turn on your computer, you're going to see certain things first that are very popular. And it's very hard to find an old diary there right away. It takes a lot of hunting. Mm-hmm. But I love that in this day and age, so many writings from the past are being digitized, and it's making it possible for someone like me, I'm based in Salt Lake City, Utah, to read someone's diary who maybe grew up in Berlin and find out all about their most innermost thoughts right from where I sit. So it's a great time to be alive and a great time to be interested in hearing women's voices from the past.
And all the people that kept these journals and diaries safe. I mean, I think that's also what blows my mind, especially if you think, for example, I'm in Berlin, we've had two world wars. There's been a lot of transition in Europe. It's very difficult to imagine that these diaries of voices that might not have been considered, big famous voices at that time, would be kept safe and sound, and yet they're still available, which is a great gift.
There is something so powerful about a diary. I think that people understand that and they reverence that. They understand that these are something that are so private, so special, so unique, that it makes people want to save them, even if they didn't really know the person well as a famous person. That said, there are a lot of writings that have been lost, and it's sad when we can't find something. One person in my book, she's actually on the cover of my book, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. She was a wonderful activist and a very powerful and loud voice for equality during her time. But her very first book, the first book that she wrote, was lost for over 100 years. Nobody could find a copy. You know, at the time she wrote that, she wasn't quite so famous as she became later on in her career. And people didn't realize how precious this was. And most of the copies of that book were lost. And it wasn't until very recently that a historian was combing through an archive at a local, it was just a local history society that preserved papers from their local community. And they finally found her very first book, which had been lost for generations in this box of papers that nobody had looked through for decades. And so it's so exciting when something like that happens and you can recover some voice that was lost.
Right, exactly. Recover some voice that's lost. I think that is this lineage of voice that it can be in recordings, it can be in scraps of paper, it can be in diaries. It's just these thoughts that reverberate and echo across generations, you know, and they get passed on. And it's so phenomenal, the power of a voice. Do you yourself write a journal? I'd be curious. Do you keep a diary of all your thoughts of what you've gone through and also coming to your own understanding of voice?
Yes, that's actually how my feminist journey as an activist began. There was a time when I was a young mom and I was keeping an online blog to share with my friends and family that was mostly just, you know, fun things. Here's a picture of my child. Here's a picture of my pet. Here's a funny thing that happened to me today. And so I had a blog like that where I was sharing things that aren't very private but are just kind of pleasant and fun. And I started thinking seriously about issues of gender equality and writing these things out on my blog, but not publishing them, just keeping them as a diary and not posting them publicly, because I thought nobody wants to hear this. They want to hear a funny story or see a cute picture. Nobody wants to hear these not so pleasant thoughts I have about gender equity. And so I was writing them and keeping them as a diary and not publishing these thoughts for a very long time. And at last I realized I need some feedback. I can't keep talking to myself in a vacuum like this. I need to hear what other people think about these things I'm thinking. And at that time, I went looking for a place that I could share my voice. And it just so happened that my husband, who worked at a hospital, he had a chaplain at the hospital who was a member of my faith and a woman, which is very rare because, like I said, in our faith, only men hold the priesthood. And so it's unusual for a woman to have a position in which she's in that kind of a clergy type role. And so he talked to her and said, asked her if she had any ideas for me. And she referred me to a group of activists, a group of women who were a Mormon feminist organization. And I went to their website, I pulled it up, I looked at it for about 10 seconds and thought, oh, this looks like what I'm looking for. And I immediately posted one of those diary entries. I sent it in and said, do you want to publish this? And that was the first time I had ever shared my thoughts. And I didn't know the community at all. I hadn't looked into it very well. But that was my first encounter with an activist community within my faith. And it was a wonderful first step. People started talking to me. I found out that my thoughts weren't so strange and unique as I'd thought, but many other people had similar ideas. I also found that there were a lot of people who hated what I had to say, that I got a lot of vitriol from more traditional people, especially the first time one of my blog posts went viral and started to be read not just by that feminist community, but by other people who weren't so into feminism, who didn't share that opinion. And I did receive a lot of vitriolic comments, and I was surprised to find that I was fine. I had been dreading sharing my thoughts and wondering what people would think and if people would hate me. And now some people did hate me. Some people did not appreciate my thoughts, and I was fine. I was stronger than I had thought.
That's powerful. What made it able for that clergywoman to actually, was she then ordained? What was the exception to the rule that she managed to have?
That woman, she worked on that project for 25 years.
Wow.
To obtain her position. So she tried to go to school to become a chaplain, mm-hmm. and the school said, well, you need to have an ecclesiastical endorsement. In other words, your church needs to say, we give you permission to attend the school. And the church wasn't going to do that. They only gave permission to men at the time. Mm-hmm. And so she kept coming back. She kept contacting people. She found a school that was willing to let her in without the endorsement. So she got her degree. And then she had to find a job that was willing to hire her without an endorsement because she still didn't have one. And after several years of working in that job as a chaplain, at last, the church changed its policy and signed her endorsement after she already mm-hmm. had the job and been doing it for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do we as women, although we have to say here that a feminist can also be a man, it's a feminist is someone, as far as I know the definition, who believes in the equality of both sexes, right? I mean, that's a feminist. It does not have to be a female. It can be male or female. It's somebody who believes in equal rights for both sexes, correct?
That's right. And I think that's yeah. really important to look at when you're looking at American history, because some of our first feminists were men. Men mm-hmm. like William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, both of them were very powerful abolitionists. So they mm-hmm. were working as activists to end slavery in the United States. And they realized that they couldn't do this alone. They needed the power of women's voices alongside men's voices. And they became activists for women because as long as women were silenced, they couldn't help in them. They couldn't participate in these causes they really believed in. And right. so they needed to break the taboos and break the silence so that women could work with them towards the abolition of slavery and other causes that both men and women cared about.
So this is another question for me. With all the inequality and injustice that we see and experience, many women, they feel paralyzed and numb, and they pull back and their voices close off, especially in light of the current political environment, where other women, rightfully so, they might have a lot of rage and feel absolutely frustrated and need to express and to raise their voices. How can we have a practice that makes us able to have deep listening, integrate these powerful emotions, and keep ourselves in balance and in flow and staying positive so that we don't shut down, so that we can see that we're moving forward?
I think we need to remember our philosophy as feminists. We are people who believe in women and care about women, and that mm-hmm. includes ourselves. So when we're looking at these important issues, we also need to look about how this is affecting us personally. There is something so inherently rewarding about raising your voice and making yourself heard. That said, there are also times when you may need to step back and take a break, because as a person who cares about women, you need to recognize that as an individual, you have a right to happiness, you have a right to solitude, you have a right to peace, and you are not required to be out there on the battlefield at every moment. Mm-hmm. It's okay to step back and take care of yourself. But then as you're doing that, you know, you can learn about some of the people who came before you. That's been replenishing for me, has been to learn about the inspiring stories of those people who paved the way. And that kind of refreshes me and gets me ready to go out and work as an activist today in our modern day world.
Are those stories included in your new book?
Absolutely, yes. I've shared many of the wonderful stories I learned from diverse feminists who started the movement in America. And it's exciting to see what they accomplished. And it really makes me feel ready to go out there and take on the world.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a daily voice practice that keeps you focused and in balance so that you can really follow your intuition. If you need to take more time, I found those very wise words that you just shared, that the love for taking care of ourselves, and that it's okay also maybe not to attend all meetings and just cook a beautiful meal and be nurtured or take a break. Do you have a practice that helps you be that spokesperson for women's rights and yet also stay nurtured and calm and peaceful?
There are a couple things that I do. One, this will surprise people, because usually when they think about self-care, they think about like relaxing in the tub and, you know, getting more rest. One of the things I do is I get up early. I get up early before there are crowds of people making demands on me and expecting me to do things for them so that I'm alone. I get up early, I'm alone, and I have peaceful time by myself to read, to study, to think. And that really helps me to start my day right.
It's lifestyle to your world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
I'm Kathy Williams, host of Sexy Mom Abundant Life radio show on Thursdays at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific. On the show, we explore living abundantly in every area of your life. Ways to let go of limiting patterns and beliefs and to step into the flow of creativity and possibility, knowing you are supported by the universe.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Hi, everybody. We are back in studio, and with me today is the modern-day feminist activist and wonderful voice of April Young Bennett. She just brought out a new book, and I would like to actually dive into language with you, April. We know that language does influence our conditionings and belief systems, and as a mother, I have been very aware that 90% of what I've seen children learn often from textbooks is very much from a white male perspective, from Aristoteles and Plato and Einstein and Whitman, Goethe, Mozart, Brahms, Bach, I can continue, Shakespeare, keep on going on. And how can we influence not only that we raise our voices, but bring an awareness to the fact that although these were, of course, wonderful minds and writers and scientists and artists, their being only coming from the male perspective is shaping also the way that we communicate. So how does education influence issues such as equality?
If you've only ever heard about men, white men, accomplishing certain things or having wise words of wisdom that are passed down from generation to generation, it can certainly give you the idea that women and people of color don't have anything worth sharing. Mm-hmm. And that's a dangerous idea for people to have. And right. Unfortunately, it is a side effect of much of the way we educate people today, because you're right, our curricula do tend to be largely androcentric. And so that is one of the reasons why I wrote this book. The book, actually, I didn't set out to be an author. Like I said, I'm an activist. I set out to be an activist, to change the world, to support causes I cared about. And as I started doing this, I began thinking, I need to know more about the people who came before me, about what other women like me have done to make their voices heard. And so I was thinking, I'm an activist, I'm a mom, I'm a career woman. I am busy. I am much too busy to go back and re-educate myself to fill in all of those years of elementary, secondary, and college education with female stories. So I need maybe just to find one book that I can read really quickly that's entertaining, that I can just read right now and to get my hands wrapped around this. And I looked for that book that I wanted. I wanted something that had a lot of diverse perspectives because I was working in activism and I knew that not everybody was Susan B. Anthony, which was basically the only suffragist most American women have heard of. I knew that there were lots of people who were different from her, who had a different outlook, who participated in the movement, but I didn't know their names. I didn't know what they did. I didn't know what their words were. So I wanted something more broad than just here's the life of Susan B. Anthony. And I wanted something relevant to what I was doing today. I wanted something that focused on how people were addressing those same problems, what their strategies were, how they built relationships. And I didn't find it. And that led me to read virtually everything. I started off reading history books and biographies. Mm-hmm. And a problem with reading biographies, even though I love biographies, is that if you read a biography, you kind of see one person as the hero. And you're reading about this one person's story as if they are the hero of the world and everyone else just kind of revolves around them, which is, you know, the way the genre works. But activism doesn't work that way. As an activist, I know that I'm collaborating with people all over the place and that solitary heroes accomplish nothing. Mm-hmm. You really need large groups of individuals working together, many of whom won't agree with each other, many of whom have different backgrounds from each other and don't see the world in the same way. And so that's what I was looking for. I didn't find it. I started reading everything. When I started reading these history books and biographies and I wanted to delve deeper, that's when I started searching for these archives where I could find letters and diaries and the actual original words of these women and men who started the movement. And eventually, I decided to put all that information together into a book, basically the book I had looked for in the beginning when I started this journey and didn't find.
Right. Yeah, I think that a lot of us, or a lot of people, at least I went, you know, through the whole university system, think that the Seneca Falls Convention was suffrage marches at the turn of the century. That's the birth of the women's movement, right? And then it was kind of that was like one big happening. But what you talk about a lot, which I found really important, is that not only how they found their voices to speak, but that these women were forbidden to speak and they were shouted down and they were refused into the universities. You know, a lot of women wanted to study in the university. They were not able to study in the university. They were marginalized, all these many things, but they rose because they came together and gave each other counsel. They rose because what you were saying, these big meetings where people might have different opinions, but they did come together across great distances. And this was happening before email and before text message and before the internet, which is phenomenal, right? I mean, this is years ago. How they organized as a group can be very enlightening, I would think.
Absolutely. As a modern activist, I told you about how I discovered another community of individuals online. So I went online, I found other people who cared about the same things I cared about. They didn't have that back then.
Right.
So they had to work a little harder, but they did. They worked very hard to find each other. And when they did, you would see in their letters, if you read their letters, somebody would hear about maybe from a newspaper story, somebody else giving a speech somewhere who agreed with something that they agreed with, something about equality that they cared about. And they would send a letter to this person, peppering them with questions, just a big, long letter of, hey, tell me about this and this and this. And then that person would write back, and they would have many, many answers to their questions and many questions for them, too. And pretty soon they would be corresponding. And it was almost the same way that we might, say, talk to each other on social media or via text, where one person would ask a question and the other would respond. Today, we do that very quickly. I have a question for you. I text it off. You immediately respond with an answer to that. If you have a question, you send me that question. They couldn't do it that quickly, and so they did it in a more long-form way, where they would ask many, many questions in one letter, give many, many answers in one letter. But if you set them side by side, you can see them having a conversation just like we would today.
And also they had maybe some time in between to really contemplate and deepen their thoughts before the next letter went out into the mail. Sometimes I appreciate that, people that still, you know, write letters or write emails where we're allowed to have a week or two or three in between answering, because some of these questions are very complex. And it's good to have time before we shoot off the next email. How do you think we can join our voices together and facilitate lasting change using the tools that we have, social media being one, webinars? I mean, it's never been easier, actually, to get information.
It has never been easier. It's also never been quite so noisy. So there's a lot of information coming out. It's almost sometimes it feels like there's too much. Like, it's how do you break through all of this and decide who to listen to or what to say when there's just so much going on? And just like it's easier to find people who have great ideas, people that you really are inspired by, it's also easier now to find hecklers out on the internet, trolls, people out to just pull you down. There's more of everything. And so you have to channel yourself. What do I care about? What is important to me? And I would never recommend that somebody go away from social media. Personally, as an activist, I love social media.
Yeah,
but it can pull you down if you're not using it in the right way and if you're letting those negative comments get to you. And so if you're starting to feel that way, it's time to set down your phone and talk to real people in real life for a few minutes.
Right.
Don't always be staring at that world. And when you are looking at that world, it's important to remember that people are different on the internet than they are in real life. I've talked to people who are just perfectly lovely in real life, who are downright nasty on the internet. And so I try to take a step away from it and say, this is, the internet is its own world. Well, people aren't necessarily themselves. So I try to step back and say, okay, this is useful. It's a wonderful tool. It's a great way to communicate. But I also need to acknowledge this person who seems so awful on the internet may not be quite like that in real life. So I'm not going to take that too seriously.
Is it because they feel more protected that they then can voice maybe judgments or views that they normally wouldn't voice face to face?
Yes, I think it is the anonymity, and it's also context. Mm-hmm. Anonymity makes people feel very comfortable to say anything. I'm not a big fan of anonymity. I don't use anonymity. I know many people who use pen names. I don't do that because I want to take responsibility for anything I say. And I don't want to say anything I wouldn't be comfortable having quoted. So I always use my own name because I know that I'm going to be associated with any words that come out of my mouth or are typed into my computer or my phone. Right. So that's one thing I do to keep myself the same person in real life and on the phone, but I know that not everyone does.
Yeah.
Another thing is context. When you're having these conversations online, you're missing a lot of context. You don't know the background of the person you're talking to. Sometimes you don't know the person at all. You don't know where they're coming from, how they're living, what's brought them to their conclusions. And sometimes you just jump into a conversation when, for example, this happens a lot. Somebody will say, look at this awful thing someone said, and they'll like post a screenshot of somebody saying something ridiculous. But you didn't see the rest of the conversation. You don't know what brought them to say that, if they really meant it in that way. And so I think it's important to remember you don't have all the context here. And that's one of the things that makes online communication difficult sometimes.
Yeah, correct. How do we need to be able to choose our battles that we're fighting in order to get our voices heard?
You know, one thing that I look at the suffragists as an example to was there was a time when they became very passionate about dress reform, and they were so right. At their time, women were expected to wear corsets, which would squish up their bodies into tiny bits, and long dresses and petticoats, even in extremely hot weather. And this uniform, it was dangerous. They worked with fire a lot then, cooking at the hearth. And if somebody, and they had candles. If somebody dropped a candle or bumped into the hearth, these gigantic skirts, they could burst into flames. This was not good. And so these women, they were absolutely right in saying women should be allowed to wear pants like men. And so they started a movement that we call the Bloomer Movement. They didn't call it that. They called it Freedom Dress. And they said, we're not going to wear these big corsets. We're not corsets and big skirts. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to wear bloomers. And they were right. And they worked really hard at it. And they had so much street harassment. And it was hard on them. Their families would get upset. Everywhere they went, people would recognize them. Like, they were used to, if they weren't terribly famous, some of them were extremely famous, but those that weren't the most famous, they could kind of be anonymous when they're sitting on the train and then go out and give a big speech in front of people. Everyone would know who they were when they were giving the speech, but they could, you know, anonymously ride on a train and or walk down the street without too many people recognizing them. That changed when they were wearing bloomers. They had street harassment all the time. They had people coming at them. We talked about that personal time that you need sometimes to kind of reflect. They couldn't have that anymore because people would see them and recognize them by their clothing and start harassing them right away. And it was like they were constantly in the battlefield. And so in the end, they gave up. They said, this is not a battle worth fighting. We have other causes we really care about, like suffrage, like bodily autonomy, like equal access to education, the wage gap. These things are more important to us than this dress reform movement. And so in the end, most of them decided, okay, we're going to go back to wearing the same clothes everyone else wears, not because we weren't right, because they were right. They were absolutely right that women should be allowed to wear pants, but because it wasn't as important as the other issues they cared about, and it wasn't important as their own mental health.
Right. That's a great way to look at it. April, we're coming to the close of this amazing interview. If you had a vision for our future on how we can use our voice and our voices to shape shift humanity for the better, what would it be?
I would tell people to acknowledge that your voice is important. I think that's the first step a lot of people have to take, is understanding that their voice matters, that it does make a difference for them to say something. And once you get past that hurdle, the next hurdle, I think, is understanding that people will disagree with you and you will be okay. And if you understand that, I think you are ready to raise your voice.
Beautiful. Where can the people find your new book and let them know your homepage now that we have a few more moments?
My book is Ask a Suffragist: Stories and Wisdom from America's First Feminists. It's available wherever good books are sold. If you visit my website, askasuffragist.com, you can find links there to the book on Amazon or at your local bookstore. And I would encourage you to join us at askasuffragist.com and join the conversation.
I think that's an excellent idea, and I know a few schools that I would love to buy a copy of this wonderful new book that just got released on the market. I think also a few family members that I have would really appreciate it. And and I really thank you for being with me today here at Om Times Radio at Voice Rising, and for sharing that rich history that we have as men and women feminists that are passionately voicing for equality. Yeah. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.